about the importance of religious liberty, that much, much good can and will come. I have an interest in this topic, not only because I'm a human being, but I'm a graduate of Brigham Young University, although not its law school. I attended the University of Virginia Law School, but for a number of years I was the general counsel to the university, and my primary responsibility was to work on religious liberty issues for American colleges and universities. So I'm excited to be here today because of that interest. But I'm currently a federal appeals court judge in Washington, D.C. We are honored to have as our speakers today two distinguished jurists. Their biographies are available to you, and so I won't take into their time by reading those biographies. We're grateful to have Judge Zagolodnyi from Ukraine, the judge of the Supreme Court of Ukraine, and Judge Clifford Wallace, former chief judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, one of the most distinguished courts in the United States, if not the whole world. We will begin first by hearing from Judge Zagolodnyi, who will speak. Following his remarks, we'll hear from Judge Wallace, and then there will be, we trust, ample time for questions and comments from you. So with that, I will turn the time over to Judge Zagolodnyi.
Доброго дня, пані і панове. Я дуже радий бачити вас всіх на цьому величному симпозіумі щодо релігії і права людини. Перш за все, я хочу від імені голови Верховного суду України, пана Романюка, подякувати за запрошення взяти участь у цьому 20-річному щорічному міжнародному симпозіумі з питань права і релігії. Для мене особисто
you start over at the beginning again. There was no translator.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I apologize for the technical difficulties with translation. I'm very happy to be in this room. And first of all, on behalf of the President of the Supreme Court of Ukraine, Mr. Romanyuk, I would like to thank you for inviting me to participate in the 20th Annual International Symposium on Points of Law and Religion. For me, as for a judge of the Supreme Court of Ukraine, I honor to be a member of this forum to participate in a discussion of pressing issues and share our experience. After all, we live in a globalized world. In the process of globalization, it is natural collision, interaction, and integration of different cultures and religious systems. All the more religion disappears attachment to its national boundaries. Religion finds its supporters around the world. The rapid development of religious life in Ukraine should be seen as an objective process and, in part, as a process of self-determination of Ukrainian society. establishing certain tendencies of this process, the struggle for of its influence, places of worship leads to activation of a variety of problems. Thus, the task of the state, taking into account the interests of various religion organizations operating in Ukraine, to form a solid legal basis for relation with the church on the principles of democracy, justice, and equality. According to Art 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from 1948, as we heard today, each person has the right of freedom of thought, consistency of religion. This right includes freedom to change his religion or belief and freedom of manifest one's religion or belief, either individually or together with others, in public, private teaching practices, worship, in the performance of religion and ritual orders. The definition contains a number of other international instruments, such as Article 9 of the European Convention, Article 18, and others. The Constitution of Ukraine in Article 35 states that everyone has the right to freedom of belief and religion. This right shall include freedom to practice any religion or profess no religion, to perform alone or collectively religious rites and rituals, conduct religious activities. The exercise of this right may be restricted by law only in the interest of public order, health or morals, or the rights and freedoms of others. Church and religious organizations in Ukraine are separated from the state and the school from the church. No religion shall be recognized by the state as mandatory. No person shall be relieved of its obligation to the state or refuse to enforce law based on religious beliefs. In the performance of military duty contrary to the religious beliefs of a citizen, the performance of its duty shall be replaced by alternatively non-military service. According to the law of Ukraine on freedom of consistency and religious organization from 1991, and more changes specifically from last year, the state protects the lawful rights and interests of religious organization, facilitates mutual relationship of religious and ideological tolerance and respects between people who profess a religion or not practices it, between beliefs or different religions and religious organization, taking into account and respecting the tradition and internal regulation of religious organization if they do not conflict with existing legislation. The state does not interfere in the law carried out within the activities of religious organization, will not fund the activities of any organization created by the basis of religion. All religion and religious organization are equal before the law. Installation of any advantages or limitations of one religion created or religious organization to others is not allowed. Religious organizations do not perform public function. Religious organizations have the right to practice in public life and use alone with association media. A religious organization do not perform into public parties or political parties and provide financial support to political parties, not to nominate candidates for public authorities, do not conduct campaign or campaigns finance candidates in these bodies. Clerics have the right to participate in political life along with all citizens. A religious organization should not interfere with the activities of other religious organizations in any way, preaching hatred, intolerance of non-believers and believers of other faith. The religious organization must comply with applicable law and order. Collective practice of religious beliefs in Ukraine without legal personality, religious organization is extremely difficult. specifically for rent on a room, holding public services or invite representatives of foreign religious, printing and distribution of literature, and to replace military duty on alternative service, person must belong to registered organization that is included in the list of organizations whose doctrines prevents to use a weapons. Although the legislator stipulates that religious communities can exist legally without registration and without legal status, respectively, in practice, the registration is a necessary step for a group of believers who wish in any way to publicly profess their faith. Unregistered communities have virtually no rights. Obviously, this practice restricts religious freedom, as the rights to organize worship, study, and teach religion or belief, spread their beliefs, and many other arising directly from the right to religious freedom and rights should not depend on the legal status of the organization. It is important to emphasize that some religious groups able to exist without registration is extremely important because the absence of any contact with the state is part of their faith. It should be said that according to international standards, the rights to establish religious organizations are an integral part of the rights of association, and therefore a different system for registering public association and religious organization is hardly necessary in a democratic society. In general, we can define the following violations of the right of freedom of religion when registering a religious organization. The legislation sets as an executive list of form of religious organization to advance statutory system of governments. This is a clear violation of both the rights of individual to determine their own form of religious association and the right to autonomy of the religious group whose elements are independent determination of its structure and independence to manage. A second, double registration, the first by meticulously test of face compliance with legislation, and the second, the acquisition of a legal personality in general procedure for all enterprising institution and organization. The registration statute regulation of religious organization may be refused in the statute's regulations or activity contrary to applicable law. Decision to refuse registration statute, a religious organization stating the ground for refusal, notified the applicant in writing within 10 days. Activity of religious organization may be determined in connection with its reorganization, division, merger, or liquidation. In the event of religious organization is a legally entity, the provision of this law and other legislative acts of Ukraine activity may also be determined by the court. First, it could be done religious organization committed acts of inadmissibility provided for in Article 3, 5, and 17 of its law. Second, a combination of ritual or religious preaching of organization attempt on the life, health, freedom, and dignity. Three, systematic violation of religious organization establishment by law for public religious activities, worship, ritual, ceremonies, etc. Fourth, encouraging citizens to failure of its constitutional duties or actions involving gross violation of public order or interference upon the rights and property of the state, public or religious organizations. The court considers the case of termination of the religious order of a limitation proceeding under the Civil Procedure Code of Ukraine. According to the authorities to carry out the registration status of particular religious organization or prosecutor. The law does not clear grounds for refusal or registration of liquidation of a religious organization. The law also does not specify how detailed should be refusal of registration, although there should be clear what the evaluation. Also, the law does not specify how the allowable discrepancies states of religious organization and Ukrainian legislation. The rights to exercise state control over observance of legislation on freedom of religious organization are endowed with such public authorities. Ministry of Culture of Ukraine, other ministry and government services, agencies and prosecution services, local administration, local councils. Its registration could be done approximately 9 to 18 months. However, this procedure is quite bureaucratic and not clearly defined. However, religious organizations agree with this because by making such registration, no further control over their activities almost done, except when associated with the activities of foreigners. An important event, as you can see, we have differences in our law. And you can see this on example of sent Mykhailiv Church against Ukraine, making a decision to refuse registration of and this. The court finds that the state of religious communities were identified canonical and organizational subordination of the said community of this in Ukraine, of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and they show a lot of discrepancy in law. According to international standards, the rights to believe is not subject to any restrictions due to their nature. This inner freedom, inviolable own thoughts, and the state has no rights to interference in this area under any circumstances. In practical terms, this means no direct physical force, punishment, etc., or indirect forms of it are contrary to their own position, man, that put the choice to conviction under a certain example, external. In general, the legislation adequately protects this freedom. In Ukraine, there are no provision for the compulsory support of a religious organization, forced membership in organization, or religious obstacle to change. There are provision does not work on religious holidays, and etc. In Ukraine, we have times when there are religious worship without without provision from a country or from the state. A potential problem may also be entitled to refuse identification number because of religious beliefs. Meanwhile, in courts, we can see when there would be determination to give lots for the building. If we're gonna talk about criminal practices, I would like to say in 1991 we heard the hearing where was the group, the big white brotherhood. And in 1993, they flourish. And this group, White Brotherhood, this could become very dangerous for society. And there was a persecution against them. And in 1993... more than 100 people become in Orthodox Church Sofia, and they try to burn themselves. And the law enforcement detained them. In 1996, the leaders of this cult were persecuted, and the Supreme Court of Ukraine left the appeal unchanged. Ukraine differentiated from the post-USSR country, allow the freedom of religious, and and some of the flaws compensating with liberal practices of the state. A European choice of Ukraine, it's course for flourishing in the future. And right now, Ukraine only one step from become part of European Union. And then I think in this aspect, we will have more or better law, and we will have more changes, and we have law reform in Ukraine. And we hope that if Ukraine become part of European Union, we will have much more and clear law of human rights and freedom. Thank you very much.
Good morning to all of you, and thank you for those very important remarks that you made on the status of Ukraine. We have purposely invited judges from all parts of the world to be at this conference. Ordinarily, we are dealing with ideas, sharing ideas, but has to be accepted as a fact that human rights, whether religious or otherwise, are only theories until there's a court to enforce it. And no one has a right until a court enforces the right. And we thought that the organizers of the conference thought that it would be well to blend in the reality of what happens after the discussions on what the human rights are, of what actually takes place. So to that extent, we have two breakout sessions that will take out this one and one following the second plenary, which will be reports from various countries on how they deal with those issues that were discussed in the plenary session. And then this afternoon, the first plenary, the one where you always want to take a nap right after lunch, the first plenary, second plenary, we're going to have a discussion with judges. And I'm going to chair that. And there's three prominent judges, justices, who will be present. And I'm going to ask them questions, and they don't know the questions yet. And then we're going to let you ask them questions. And the idea is to then let you ask them how things work out so that you can see the other end of the tunnel of where it's going. And we think this will be very productive. And today I'm going to talk about the approach in the United States, which is far different than you're used to. Most all of the countries that we hear from are very much influenced by international norms indicated by various conventions or conferences, and we talk about them as if they were law. But in the United States, they are not. And so this may be of interest to you. But first, I want to indicate my own gratitude for having the Ukraine here. I was in the Ukraine 7 years ago, working there, and I found the judges very excited about the new Ukraine. And I am involved in a conference of chief justices of Central and Eastern Europe. We've held our fourth meeting, and the chief justice of Ukraine is always there and participates actively in our efforts to improve the judiciaries in Central and Eastern Europe. And there's a certain excitement at those conferences, because here they were under the domination of Moscow for so long, and now they're on their own developing what they need. And it's tremendous to have one of their representatives here. And I can assure you that what he talked about of freedom of religion in Ukraine is true, because we have a granddaughter who just a year ago completed her mission for the Mormon Church, and she was in Ukraine and learned to love Ukrainians and was very active. And when I go to the Ukraine, I have no difficulty finding a Mormon church that I can go visit. So I can assure you what he said is accurate. So let me then come to the United States part. Our relationship with human rights is largely based upon the history of our country and how it was developed and what our Constitution does. There's a very excellent article on the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment to the Constitution, written by Professor Michael McConnell, who was a circuit court judge but has now left the bench to make more money being a professor. We find that true everywhere. It's called the Origins and Historical Understanding of the Free Exercise of Religion. Professor McConnell explains the approaches to church-state relations before the Constitution, and then looks to the views of the framers of the First Amendment after the ratification debates. McConnell concludes that what he calls Madisonians, that is, those that followed Madison in the discussions, perspective best represents the understanding of the free exercise term. I like what he had to say because history has a lot to do with what we're doing today. My view is somewhat different, but I think comes to the same conclusion. I've written it in an article in the Brigham Young University Law Review, and it's consistent with the Chief Justice Rehnquist, our former Chief Justice, indication of what the history shows in his separate opinion in Santa Fe Schools, a case of great importance. When we came together as a group, we had a debate that went from colony to colony or state to state to whether or not we were going to accept the Constitution. The Constitution itself, as written over 200 years ago, is not a rights constitution, a rights constitution. That is, constitutions today include specific rights of people, and largely they bring those in from the declarations. That was not the purpose of the United States Constitution. The idea of the Constitution was to limit government. That is, a national government was to be formed, and the people felt that if they limited the government national powers, then in the various states, the rest of the power closer to the people would remain. So as you read the Constitution, you get an idea that there's just a limited relationship. You do not see rights, the right to this or the right to that, with one exception. There's only one right in the body of the Constitution, and that's the right to patent. Even then, in those days, you see, people understood the importance of the economy in relationship to the growth of a country. And so the right to patent was put into the body of the Constitution so the national government would not interfere with that patent right. But aside from that, there were no rights. So after the Constitution was developed, then there was an agreement that there would be amendments to the Constitution. So immediately after the adoption of the Constitution, the Federalists, the winning party in the first Congress, went to work on the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments. And the First Amendment was the one that we're dealing with here. Now, people say, well, that must be the most important amendment that they were proposing because it was first, but it wasn't. With the list of amendments that were presented by Madison, it was third. But the first two were rejected. And so that's how the First Amendment became first. That amendment does not guarantee any rights to people. What it does is provide restrictions upon the National Congress dealing with religion. And it has two clauses. The first clause is called the Establishment Clause. And what it says is that Congress cannot designate a national religion. Now, why was that important? At that time, there were still several of the states that had state-recognized religions, which were actually funded by tax money from the states. And there was nothing wrong with this. Several of them had disenfranchised, but there was nothing in the Constitution to say that this was wrong. What they didn't want to have is a national church recognized. And that's what the Establishment Clause was all about, not to have a national church. And then there's the Free Exercise Clause, which gives no rights. It prevents the Congress from interfering with the free exercise. You see what it does? These were the two things that they were interested in. Now, if you look at those two, you can see an economic approach to religion as far as a government is concerned. We're all involved now with the importance of economics in our various countries. We've found that the market approach brings great benefits individually to our countries. And if you look at the market approach, there's two things that happens. Number one, you avoid monopolies, because monopolies have a tendency not to advance, but merely to finance the monopoly. There's no reason for monopolies to improve their process because they have a monopoly group already funding them through their monopoly practice. And so they found out that what happens was if you have monopolies, it tends to decrease, not increase, the income. And they did not want such a monopoly church that would stifle continued religious involvement. And we have the same problem in many countries that have recognized a religion, a monopoly religion, and they have something in common in working with that process. Now, what they did want to do is make sure there was an interaction of religious discussions, competition. And that's what the Free Exercise Clause is for. And the thought was that if you have competitions among the various religions or sects, that competition would protect all of them. And as long as you didn't have the government interfering with that free exercise, then all the people's religious rights would be preserved. So you see, the approach wasn't governmental, that is, to establish government, establish rights, but was to try and unburden the people from government so that they themselves could have these discussions. And those religions who do not answer the rights or needs of the people would diminish and maybe would no longer exist. And those religions which help the people to develop in their beliefs would then grow larger. And the process is one, of course, just like the economy. The better products are going to win. And it's just amazing to me, as you look at what was happening at that particular time, what their approach was. Now, the difficulty, of course, that we've had is when we don't follow the Constitution and what had originally occurred. And through some of the decisions of the United States Supreme Court over the years, there's been a misunderstanding of what the Constitution said. And so we've had to deal with those problems. And then we've had the difficulty sometimes of the government, the federal government, exercising what they perceive is their legislative right in interfering with the free exercise. And those are the issues that we deal with now. It isn't preserving rights as such. The rights were going to be there. It's whether or not the government can interfere with those rights. And now, there has never been a monopoly church that's been established, but the government has adopted legislation which they see as an interference with the clause and not as giving a church, but as certain things that they say is like the government establishing a church. And that's the theory, and you can see its weakness. It has no legs underneath it. And so how do you divine that? Well, it's what the Supreme Court says it is. In our view, the Supreme Court is not final because it's right. It's right because it's final. It has the last word, and so it becomes the law, which we as subordinate judges, or as the Constitution says, in judges of inferior courts, and therefore inferior judges, except for the 9 in Washington, D.C., are bound to follow. And we have that responsibility. So with that background, then let me give a few examples of how this works out. And you can see, as it works out, that we do not embrace international documents. They are not the law of the land in the United States unless the Congress enters into a treaty and accepts them. Our international relations have been such, whether it was right or wrong, that we make sure we don't enter any treaties that are self-executing. By that I mean they are not of themselves the law. The Congress has to approve the treaty. So the president can go enter into all the treaties he wants to, but until the Congress passes an acceptance law, it does not become the law of the land. If they do accept it, then it's just like the Constitution. It's the law of the land, and we follow it. So when people talk about international law in the United States, there is no such thing as international law. There's international theories, but only to the extent that the Congress adopts it does it become part of our process. Now, having said that, do these international commitments that people make have place in our law? Of course, we're aware of them. And as we interpret laws that have to do with the international commitments, we of course have them in mind. But you won't find a judge saying, because of Article so-and-so, therefore it's the law that governs the land. It functions a little differently. And we've been criticized for this, but it's part of our Constitution and the makeup that we have. So having said that, and I'm sure the interpreters have realized that that has nothing to do with the materials I gave them, but they asked for something. And I'm sure they enjoyed reading it last night. But I want to then talk a little bit about the free exercise clause, because it becomes very, very significant. The issues that I've been talking about came to a head over a three-year period in the 1940s. I'm going back 70 years now to some cases that are very significant. The Supreme Court ruled that public schools could compel Jehovah's Witnesses to salute the flag and give the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. Jehovah's Witnesses, because of their beliefs, do not believe that they can have a pledge or salute anything other than God. And they take this as an invasion of their free exercise of religion. In Millersville School District versus Gobetz, this finally got to the Supreme Court. And while Justice Frankfurter, writing for the court, recognized that, quote, "the affirmative pursuit of one's convictions about the ultimate mystery of the universe and man's relation to it," I think that means God, "relationship to it, is placed beyond the reach of the law," close quote. He concluded that the, quote, "significance of the flag," close quote, "in the development of citizenship," outweighed that right, and the free exercise right was committed to review by the legislature rather than to the courts. And so the court was supposed to say that the Constitution doesn't allow the Congress to interfere with free enterprise, but you can see what the court is saying in Frankfurter. He's saying it's committed to the legislature. That is, the legislature can commit this. And why could they prevent young boys and girls who are committed to Jehovah's Witness principles of not saluting the flag and not pledging their allegiance to the flag? It's because of citizenship. So they've taken two issues here and not had the absolute, say, Congress cannot. It couldn't be stronger in the Constitution unless you said Congress cannot under any circumstances. Congress cannot means Congress cannot. And here's the Constitution being modified, the amendment to the Constitution being modified by the Supreme Court, saying we're going to balance that freedom that we can't enter into and can't enter to with citizenship, which we think is an important value. Justice Stone in the Supreme Court dissented from this judgment, stating that the forced statute of recitation coerced these children to express a sentiment which, as they interpret it, they were not to entertain, and which violates their deepest religious convictions. He stated that the legislation that restricts the religious freedom of small minorities should not be the subject of heightened judicial scrutiny. The Jehovah's Witnesses' resistance to the flag salute, combined with the Supreme Court's stamp of constitutionality, led it to a wave of persecution. Hundreds of Jehovah's Witnesses were attacked, often sanctioned by local law enforcement people. It was a bad part of our history in which we forgot what the founders had in mind. The Supreme Court reversed course just 3 years later in West Virginia State Board of Education versus Barnett. There, Justice Jackson, whom you may remember was chosen to be a prosecutor in the Nuremberg trials at the time some of the Nazis' top leaders were tried. This is the same Justice Jackson. Justice Jackson specifically rejected Gobetz and concluded that compulsion is not a promissory means for achieving national unity. In a famous passage, Justice Jackson explained, "If there is any fixed star to our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or any other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act that their faith therein forbids. If there are any circumstances which permit an exception, they do not occur to us now." So Justice Jackson got us back to where we were when the First Amendment was adopted. He continued that there is a sphere of intellect and spirit which the First Amendment reserves from all official control. The Supreme Court continued to wrestle with the countervailing interests of government to enact generally applicable laws with the conscience rights of religious minorities. The court held that a state could not restrict the extension of unemployment insurance to a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church who could not obtain employment because of his religious obligation to forego work on Saturday. In Sherbert versus Verner, this case is very important. In Employment Division versus, they changed directions in Employment Division versus Smith, where the Supreme Court overruled the doctrinal test from Sherbert and revised Justice Frankfurter's suggestion that free exercise claims were best left to the political process. So then we went right back to where we were. Congress took the opportunity seriously when the court said this is to be left to the legislature, and legislatively overruled Employment Division versus Smith with the Religious Freedom Protection Act. Though the law was later struck down as unconstitutional as it was applied to states, the heightened scrutiny doctrine of Sherbert still applies to the federal government, and the federal government, quote, shall not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion, even if the burden results from a rule of general applicability, close quote, unless the burden is necessary to further a compelling government interest and is the least restrictive to further that interest. So it's a very heightened scrutiny anytime you interfere with free enterprise. Now, or free expression. Now, we still are having some problems because the states were not covered by that. But I've forgotten now how many states have now adopted their own laws along the same way as the federal law. And so it has continued to be litigated in many ways, and my time has run out. But we still have problems with zoning, for example, where local communities, through zoning ordinances, interfere with the establishment of building churches on various bases, which have nothing to do with the overall mandates of how the Supreme Court now feels. We will continue to have difficulties and challenges in a vibrant economy where freedom of religion and freedom of speech is widely respected, and where certain encroachments occur, and we will continue to have them within our courts. That's about as much as I have time to tell you about what we're doing in the United States, and I hope you find it useful.
Well, thank you. I'm going to exercise the moderator's prerogative and direct the first question to both of these judges, and then after they answer, then we'll leave you all time to do so. But I couldn't help but notice in these two excellent presentations, two very different approaches coming out of two different traditions, two very different approaches to religious pluralism. And so I want to ask a question that has as its root the same premise, but I want to direct it first to Judge Wallace, and then I'm going to change the question a little bit to our guest from Ukraine. So, Judge Wallace, you have made a wonderfully lucid explanation of the approach that the United States of America has taken to religious liberty. Can you explain why it is that virtually no other tradition in the world has adopted that approach to religious pluralism? It's not a new idea. The United States has been talking about this for a couple hundred years, yet it doesn't seem to be gaining a whole lot of traction. And then we'll let you answer that, but then I want Judge Zagonia to be thinking about a related question. There is a growing body of evidence to show that in nations that adopt and embrace religious pluralism, that those societies flourish and benefit in many ways, economically primarily, but in other ways. And so in the face of that growing amount of evidence, why is it, do you think, that so many nations are resistant to the idea of religious pluralism? I mean, religious competition, regardless of national borders, opening up nations to a robust and vigorous competition amongst all religions. So with that, I'll let Judge Wallace go first, and then Judge Zagonia, and then we'll turn the time over to the rest of the audience. Thank you.
My greatest interest now, I get the most professional benefit out of it, is working with countries' judiciaries overseas. I've worked individually with some 60 countries now, in helping them make their courts more efficient, more effective. And it's the most fun I have, and that's why I still get on airplanes as much as I do. In my work in those countries, I have rarely, if ever, recommended that they adopt our approach. I've seen other models that are more relevant to what they're trying to do. The United States is just a different country with a different history. And sometimes the principles are right, but the adaptation is different. And so I never say, do it the way we're doing it. If they like the principle, then we have to make it fit within the country. And I found because of that we are different peoples. Since the time of the Tower of Babel, we've all had different histories. And those histories are important not only to our people, they're important to us in developing laws which can be accepted by the people. We have some overarching principles that are in the declarations and others, but we have needs that have to respect the local legal customs and the local histories. So we have a history of 200 years that's gone different from the history of most countries. The average length of a written constitution today is 14 years. This is a constitution that was 220 years ago was written. And so there will be a different way of approaching. I would not expect the people to all of a sudden develop something like our First Amendment and then change everything that they're doing to work through this, what I call the economic approach to these very important issues. But the principle is right. The principle is right that religions are important. I don't say that religion is a human right because we don't function that way. You do, we don't. But it is something that's of such value to our society, to our history, that we have to function in such a way that religion becomes high on the docket of protectionism because it does so much good for our country. It isn't just that it's going to church on a particular day. It's that we found that through religions, people become better citizens. They're more law-abiding, they're more nationalistic, they're more wanting to be helpful to other people. So we found that it's a good thing for religions just because of what they accomplish. So that principle, I think, is applicable everywhere. But how you do it would be different from the United States. So I don't see it as a problem where we've failed. I think we've succeeded to the extent we have succeeded because of our history. But I think other countries can and should, and many do, accomplish the same thing through development, through the human rights programs and that approach. So that's my answer to it.
As I think, or in my opinion, in those countries where there is a freedom of religious, where is a respect for the religious and for the religious organizations, where the state and government and is not interfering. And is not interfering in development of those religious organizations. Those countries, or in those countries, we see more economical development and cultural development and other aspects. I think, or in my opinion, if you're talking about Ukraine, specifically western part of Ukraine, we see more religious people. In the majority, there is Greek Catholic Church, and people in those states are so united. They celebrate religious holidays together. Students go to school very, very lifted. And this has a positive influence to the families for their work performance. And even in the first grade, they see the church schools or Sunday schools. And kids go to those. They are study religious there. And this has a positive influence for the development of those regions. And when we see some distractions we see some problems between different churches, for example, Orthodox, Ukrainian Orthodox with Kyiv Patriarchate versus Moscow one, we see some not very healthy interactions sometimes. And sometimes they fight over some places or churches, and it does not help for people. So in my opinion, if everything is okay as far as freedom of religious, it's the beneficial for not just the people, but for the country overall. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now it's your turn to ask questions. We have Daniel Ortney back here who will, if you'll raise your hand and be recognized. And then if you will, please, if you will say to whom you would like to direct your question, and then that judge can, or you can direct it to both or either, but just let us know who you would like to direct your question towards. So great.
My name is Renata Witz. I'm from Hungary. Thank you very much for both wonderful presentations. I actually have a question to Judge Zagalodny. In 2010, the Ukraine underwent a big judicial reform, which also affected appointment, dismissals, and judicial training, and the entire court structure. Now, in the Universal Periodic Review this summer, the UN Human Rights Committee was suggesting very strongly that judges in the Ukraine should receive training to be able to apply domestic laws of the Ukraine in light of the standards and jurisprudence under the covenant. I wonder what your views are on the Ukrainian court's abilities to apply international human rights law, and what is the reality of this, and maybe if you could extend your response also to the standards as they were developed in the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights, it would be very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. What I would like to say in Ukraine, we have a lot of work done by government and state for human rights in our country, and based on religious questions and their recognition. Let's say that courts are just looking into, criminal legislation, per se, functioning by military, and based on religious belief, so somebody does not participate in army, or there are some civic rules where we talk about lots for building of the churches. For the registration churches and court, always following the local law, and they following that law without determining or dominating one or the other churches. And you mentioned that judges from Ukraine need to receive additional training about human rights. I don't think, or I don't have that information that we had suggested to us to get this training. I think we following the law. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was a wonderful representation from the two judges. The first intervention is about the USA presentation. What are some of the situations that are considered violating other people's religious practices? In a way, we have a number of things to restrict the Congress from intervening on the others. But when you deal with public issues, there are also times where the other people may be intervening on the other's right. So in that case, how it is seen from the judge point of view. And I'm particularly wondering what are some of the examples in this regard that can be considered at that level. My second point is to my Ukraine colleague. There are, on the registration process, it is indicated that most of them, they do register, but it is also indicated if they decline not to register, that is also accepted, if I were not wrong. So I'm wondering how these two parameters work at the same time in terms of engaging them in the what to call productive process. Thank you so much.
I think the first question was for me. And as I understand the question, it is, are there certain restrictions placed upon religion? That is, does free exercise mean you could do anything? And that, of course, is always the problem. When you give somebody a freedom, some believe that's freedom to do anything. But in a society, sometimes it runs into other values, such as criminal law procedures. And that's the place where the United States has been pretty strongly involved. It started 150 years ago, actually, when a case called United States versus Reynolds. It was a case where people of the supporting this conference, the Mormon Church, were living polygamy, much like Muslims have the right to marry four under the practice in the Mormon Church. You had to be called to be a polygamist, and you had to have the approval of the first wife. So it became much more limited than a guarantee of four wives. And there's about 10% of the church at the highest point was practicing polygamy. A case was brought against a man named Reynolds, who was a polygamist, on the basis of the law of bigamy, that you can't marry more than one spouse. And the United States Supreme Court said that even though they recognize free exercise of religion, and Congress cannot do anything to interfere with the free exercise of religion, this is something Congress did in establishing a criminal law, and therefore they could do it. Now, it would seem to me that that's a good principle as long as it isn't improperly used. But even today, if people wish to use, at least so far, use marijuana as a part of their religion, they're not allowed to do that. You can't kill animals. There are certain things that are restricted because of criminal laws. As those criminal laws may change, then the free exercise part may change. But yes, there are limitations, and the court has done a pretty good job of balancing those limitations. The ones that we have had most difficulty with are the limitations that are done theoretically for some other reason, like zoning churches who don't have a lot of people there, but they just happen to be Muslim, or they happen to be Jewish, or some other religion that in that particular community is not well accepted. Those are the kinds of problems we're having now to differentiate. Are they really restrictions because of general application of laws, of criminal laws, or are they really ones that are being misused locally in order to enforce their views on particular religions? But free exercise does not go beyond the laws of the land.
The question that I had in regards of registration of the churches in Ukraine and how it's usually happening in practice. the church sign a petition to get a land for this church. And this has to be looking over by local law authority. And if they need to register the land, then that lot will be passed to that church or religious organization. As I said in my presentation, it's a little bit bureaucratic system in Ukraine because it takes usually for the registration of the church a year or year and a half. However, that religion organization is waiting for the ruling. And I would like to say that right now in Ukraine, specifically in Kyiv, most churches are Ukrainian Orthodox with a Moscow Patriarchate. Why this church flourishing right now? Because in Ukraine, they, specifically in Kyiv, they have a lot of land for development of the church. At first, they do a small chapel, and later on, they build a big temple. And usually that's what's happening. I'm not sure why. Maybe it's because of the government, but I can see this happening right now. Because right now we see more registration of this particular church. Thank you. If they are not registered, then they are going into court. In administration court of law, where they declare to register such a church. If there are they are legitimate organization, they will be registered.
Okay. Question?
The schedule says that we are now finished.
About a quick one.
Okay, a quick question.
All right. Drew Clark, the Deseret News. I'd be interested in your quick reactions to the notion of using the free expression part of religion, I guess, to conflate it with the notion of freedom of expression. You know, free exercise of religion, freedom of expression. In the United States, the Bill of Rights has both of those in the same section, and there's been a dialogue about whether freedom of speech, religious freedom are different in tension. Do you think it is appropriate to continue to think, or to not to continue to, but to think of these as the same freedom, or are there disadvantages to thinking of freedom of religion in a different way from freedom of the press and of speech?
I'm always hesitant to answer questions like this specifically, because then the case comes before me, and they say, you've already made up your mind. You said at Brigham Young University, and it's recorded here on the point. Let me just say this, which I think is general enough that I can still sit on the case. I was taken last night by our colleague from England with the idea that as soon as you say religion and, that there's a different mixture that takes place. That is, if you do and, then you have to have the same opportunities, the same protections, where maybe in certain instances one or the other should have greater protections as you do this balancing that is done openly in European courts and done in the way we think about things before we write the opinion. So I'm always hesitant to make one equal the other unless the Constitution itself has made it clear. I see no problem in thinking about it. I think the problem is applying it. You never know what's going to happen once you identify one goal with another goal. When you pick up one end of the stick, you pick up the other end of the stick. And where it may be a good idea to make an identification at the particular time, 10 years from now, there may be a reason why you don't want them the same, that one of them has been diminished, and this one shouldn't be diminished with it. And so I'm a little concerned about changing a process where we are so bound by the Constitution and its interpretation to unify things which are not directly unified. On the other hand, I think it's great to think about it because it enlivens us. And as judges, we need to absorb continuous thought because the Constitution and our laws are a series of principles that we apply. And we have to have that. So I say, yes, continue to think about them. But I would be hesitant to write the opinion that said they were equal.
I'll be less hesitant. It's a bad development. Are you here as a reporter there, Drew?
Yeah.
Not for that. Not for that. Okay. Well, with that, I want to thank our speakers very much. If you'll join me in giving them a round of applause. And I've been asked to remind you that lunch for the delegates and invited guests is at 12:30. It's about a 10-minute walk from here, and I trust there are people who are going to give us directions, but it's on the other side of the campus. So,
and don't forget, we're going to have the conversation with the judges immediately after lunch here in this room.
Nicely done. That was very nice.
Oh, thank you.